This land is your land. This land is
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
All right, everybody, welcome to The People Speak radio show. Sorry for the delay. Had some technical problems here. Fortunately, this doesn't happen very often. In fact, it's never happened before that, you know, while I've been hosting. It just stinks that it had to happen now when we have some, you know, very important guests on. But we actually don't have both our guests. We're going to be having Oliver Stone on shortly. We're still waiting for him, but we do have his co-author of his latest book, The Untold History of the United States. We're joined right now by Peter Kuznick, his co-author, and we're hoping to get him on here pretty soon. We only got about a half hour left of the show here, but welcome to the show, Peter.
Thanks, Charles. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you on. I've been thumbing through your book. It looks fantastic, and of course, you guys are also working on an upcoming TV series that's going to be aired on Showtime.
Well, it's actually been airing already. This week, we're showing episode number 4.
Oh, it has been airing. I'm sorry. I didn't even know
yes.
that. Okay. Okay.
The first one is about World War II. The second is about the roots of the Cold War during World War II. The third is about the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the start of the nuclear arms race. And the fourth, which just began airing yesterday, is about the Cold War, the 1945 to 1950 period, the start of the Cold War.
Excellent. Very important part of American history and a very dark part of American history, and one that unfortunately many people are in the dark about. They're not very well informed about what went on in these important periods.
That's our concern, is that, well, two problems, really. The first problem is that people don't know much history, and the second problem is that much of what they do know is wrong. So that's what we're confronting. The National Report Card that was issued last year concluded that 12% of high school seniors are proficient in U.S. history. That's actually lower than in math and the sciences. So we always bemoan the fact that American students are so far behind other students in math and science. They're actually weakest when it comes to U.S. history.
That's really sad. And that's yeah. one subject that should have the most stress put on, you know, the most emphasis placed on. It's been said that
you think to be a responsible citizen, you need to know your country's history and you need to know the history of the world.
Sure.
Unfortunately, most Americans don't have very much of a background when it comes to this and very much understanding or insight. And that's what we're trying to rectify here. We're trying to deal with that question and trying to get people to think a little bit more critically and analytically about U.S. history. Get beyond the myths. Get beyond this triumphalist narrative about the United States, which is a very, very partial reading of U.S. history.
So talk us through, if you will, the book actually goes back further than your first broadcast, starting with World War One, right?
Yes.
You guys, yeah.
Well, the first broadcast starts really with World War II, but the book goes back to the 1890s. The book goes back to the
even before,
Empire.
Sure, yeah, even before World War One.
We go into some detail about the Spanish-American War.
Sure.
Even before that, we've got a certain vision of empire that Seward and others laid out in the late 19th century, and then we go into so after we lay out what that vision of empire was. Then we go into the Spanish-American War, and we talk about the Filipino insurrection and the fact that the United States intervened to crush the Filipino insurrection. And that was an important turning point in American history, because
right.
before that point, the United States was seen universally as a pro-revolutionary, pro-reform force, a progressive force in the world. But with the crushing of the Filipino insurrection, a very popular insurrection led by Aguinaldo, the United States begins to line up on the other side. The United States becomes a status quo force, a counter-revolutionary force, a force that's going to fight for fight progressive change around the world, which is pretty much of the legacy, not entirely, but a big part of the story for the 20th century. Because after that, we begin intervening throughout Latin America and the Caribbean and Central America, one country after another, occupation, sometimes occupation lasting for years, in, as we're trying to create stability down there so that American business can thrive. And when there are revolutionary regimes in Latin American countries, the United States does what it can to prevent those revolutions from occurring if they're popular revolutions.
Yeah, we tend to think of American imperialism as something that emerged in the post-World War II era, but that's not the case. It actually...
No, it really starts much earlier.
Yeah. Well, you could argue, really, the I think you mentioned this in the book. I remember, but I skipped through kind of quickly. I'm going to go back later and read, from cover to cover. But the Mexican-American War.
We don't really touch on that very much, but it certainly is a good example, as Lincoln understood better than anybody. The whole history of the United States.
Okay, I understand Oliver Stone has now joined us. Welcome, Mr. Stone.
Thank you. Is this Charles?
He's not coming through too clear. Want to try again?
This is Charles?
Yeah.
Hello?
Okay, now I guess we got him.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
You weren't coming through clear at first. Yeah, welcome, Mr. Stone. It's an honor to have you on.
Thank you. Is this Charles?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were just talking about some of the details of your book, going back to the post-World War I era American imperialism starting very early on, much earlier than what most people are aware of in this country. Most people not even aware that we're actually an empire, let alone how long we've been doing this, which is pretty sad.
Yeah.
But before we continue that conversation, I just wanted to say, I'm very honored to have you on. You were probably the person that is responsible more than anybody else that got me interested in politics and how our government functions.
Really?
Your JFK film 20 years ago or 20-somewhat years ago, I think it was 1992, wasn't it, when it was released?
91,
okay, so 21 years. Yeah, that's really what got me started. After I saw that, it changed my perception. I, of course, went out and got On the Trail of the Assassins. I read his book. And, it's just been one awakening after another ever since, just when you think you heard it all. Nope, you keep digging and you find more. So I just wanted to say, I thank you for that film. That JFK film is just, it's a classic. It's fantastic.
Well, thank you very much.
But anyway, we were talking about, the Spanish-American War and some of the fiascos that went on with that. It wasn't quite what we were told that it was. Basically, I want to give you guys the floor and take us where you want to take us. There's so much ground to cover. Did you want to make any comments yourself, Mr. Stone, about the Spanish
War? Well, no, because I'm jumping in the conversation. I think Peter was talking. Maybe, can you? He continue, and then I'll feel my way.
Okay.
We were just giving Oliver was just giving some background about the U.S. history before the period when the documentaries begin. We were talking about the 1890s up through the interventions in Latin America.
Yeah. We cut that because of. It was originally going to be a 12-part series. We had to make it 10 because we went 2 years over our schedule to finish this. It took 4.5 years.
Oh, I bet. This is so much material,
sure. It was the most ambitious and excruciating job I think I've ever been on in terms of trying to render this into a, to simplify it. And film is very tactile, but film can teach you a lot quickly. A book is another experience, and the book complements the series and is obviously, goes into more detail. But the book would take about 100 hours to render on film.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I bet. I haven't actually seen any of them yet. I got some of your DVDs. I'm going to be watching them in the coming days. But
it's on Showtime, on demand. TV, it's demand TV. It's also Showtime. which a lot of people don't have, but perhaps they have on demand in their home.
On demand, yeah, I'll have to catch it there. I don't actually have Showtime.
We're up to chapter 4 this week, but hopefully you can backtrack it to chapters 1 through 3.
I imagine you guys are getting rave reviews. I know your book is selling very well.
Book is selling well, bestseller, reviews. Yeah, we have good reviews, and, you know, the usual preventers, blockers of history who'd want to control the truth. I mean, a lot of people are, you know, it's sort of a lot of the things we say are backed up by, most of everything we say is backed up by scholars, and all the facts are indisputable. It's the interpretations that are not. And unfortunately, you know, this is the notions of that are expressed in these films have been denied a presence for so long by the establishment media. And this is something that is, it's mind-boggling that we cannot deal with the fact. For example, my daughter's history books in high school, my sons, they always say the same thing. The atomic bomb is dropped because the Japanese were fanatics and it was a way to save American lives.
Right.
It's partly true, but there's so much more going on with the Soviet invasion in the East, and the Soviet invasion of Japan is about to take place. So, you know, the bomb is dropped, as we show very clearly, to scare the Russians, to make a big political point that we are going to be top dog after World War II. World War II itself is reexamined from many different aspects.
Essentially, the Japanese had surrendered at that point.
Well, they hadn't surrendered, but they were, and they would have fought. But they were down to, their economy was destroyed, and they did not react to the bomb at first. They reacted to the Soviet invasion. But there's a lot of stuff like this. But this is a founding myth of American post-war policy, the atomic bomb. It sets the rules, the new rules. We are the top dog. We are boss.
And U.S. leaders understood how weakened the Japanese were. We had been intercepting their cables. We'd broken their codes. Truman himself refers to the intercepted July 18th telegram. He calls it the telegram from the Jap emperor asking for peace. So we knew long before the end of the war that the Japanese were crippled and trying to find a way out. But we still wanted to use the bomb.
And, of course, even before that, you know, the Pearl Harbor incident, that's highly questionable as to what really went on with that.
We don't go there. No, we're dealing with, I think, the bigger points of history. I think the Pearl Harbor thing is a bit delusional because, I think you can get... We're not going into conspiracy theory. We're dealing with facts here.
Yeah.
And if we'd gotten into that Roosevelt knew or did not know, we can't prove that. So we didn't go there.
Okay. Yeah. No, it's understandable. And then, of course, you come up into the Cold War. Did you guys talk at all about the, this is highly suspicious, the Bretton Woods series of meetings?
Well, we talk about Bretton Woods in the context of starting the IMF and the World Bank.
Right.
So we certainly deal with those institutions which become so central to U.S. policy in the Cold War.
Sure. That's always bothered me that they had these financial institutions in place that wound up, you know, literally exploiting third world countries that we would invade. Conveniently, they'd wind up in debt to them, and that's a problem that still continues today.
Third world debt is still a very, very serious problem, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, I'm sure you spent a great deal of time on the Kennedy assassination. That's one of your favorite topics, Mr. Stone.
No, we didn't. We didn't.
Oh, you didn't?
The assassination is the... No, this is, as I said, films are... I did my films. I gave my interpretations. But this is a culmination of my life's work, you know, I wanted to do a hard-edged documentary with, as I say, facts are indisputable in this. So we didn't venture into all the smoky areas that exist.
Conjecture,
I may believe that. Now, we dealt with the causes and effects of Kennedy's presidency. We showed a man who was a pretty hardcore liberal Cold Warrior, but changed as a result of the Cuban Missile Crisis and other events in his presidency. We deal with, especially with the last year of his presidency. So we established that he had a lot of enemies at the end of his life, especially inside the establishment. So this is, you know, you can draw your own implications from that, but we're not, as I said, we stick to the facts that we know. And the Warren Commission stands as the final government document, though I think it has, it's been untrustworthy. It's been not trusted by the American people, but that's all we go, that's all we say. We just imply that, that truthfully, that Kennedy had made a lot of enemies inside the government.
And that's a good way to do it. You just present what is undeniable, and the people there can draw their own
conclusions.
That's correct. Yeah.
That's correct. The book is solid and could be a primer in high school for high school's junior or senior students, in my belief. And I think it reads beautifully, simply, and it's what they should be teaching in school instead of some of the traditional, you know, traditional history of the United States, which students, by the way, I don't think are very, history is one of the least popular subjects, less so than math and science.
I have to admit, when I was in high school, it bored the, I'm sure half of that was the way they taught it.
You know why it bored you? Because it's like a Disney film. You know the ending. The U.S. always comes out ahead. So in this case,
but, you know, they never taught
the
you.
Stories.
Yeah, they didn't make it interesting. They didn't teach you how to critically analyze things. They just taught you bare facts and statistics and dates. And it just, it made it very drab.
And they're doing that again now with these, the new teaching to the tests is, again, to give this kind of dry information. But we know that teachers do use documentaries in school, even in the public schools. So where it might be difficult in some places to get our book into the curriculum, there's no excuse for teachers not using our documentaries in the classroom, I think.
In public schools,
it'll be easier for them to do that. In the private schools, many have told us they're already assigning our book in private schools, and we know that a lot of universities are starting to assign it already.
Excellent.
But the major book buyers at high school level are still California and Texas especially. And Texas has perhaps the lowest standards.
But Oliver, maybe when Texas secedes from the United States, then that won't be a drag anymore.
Okay.
They can have their own history.
My only good people in Texas, I made three movies there. I appreciate them. And I know that... it's just that, you know, it's a force between the light and the dark always, a battle.
Well, you keep hearing these stories anyway about secession, but nothing's coming out of them. Did you guys go at all into the Marshall Plan? Did you discuss any of that?
Yes, we certainly talked about the Marshall Plan. We talk a lot about George Marshall.
Yeah.
We talk about Marshall's differences with Truman over a lot of important issues.
And what, you know, what was your synopsis with that? Do you think that was a good thing in the long run, or probably good for Europe, but do you think it was good for the U.S.?
The Marshall, well, actually, it was, in an economic sense, very good for the U.S. because the stipulation was that most of that money had to be spent on U.S. goods. So they were purchasing goods from American manufacturers, and that helped boost the U.S. economy during that period. $13 billion was spent, and that was a lot of money during that time.
So probably better for U.S. businesses than for Europe itself.
Well, it was beneficial to Europe, too. I mean, if you contrast the Marshall Plan with the kind of militaristic responses that we saw to the Soviet Union during that time, the Marshall Plan was a much more intelligent approach and a much more constructive approach than the kind of militarized responses that were also going on. There was another side to the Marshall Plan, and a lot of money was diverted from the Marshall Plan into covert operations. We talk about that also. It's important for people to know that.
Did you deal with the possibility, and again, I know you didn't want to speculate, you just wanted to present the facts, but in your coverage of the Lusitania, did you see anything suspicious there, or... almost as though
we know that it was carrying arms, so that is well known, even though it was denied at the time.
Right, it was supposed to be neutral.
The questions of World War One that we're dealing with are again a little bit different. There are all these secret agreements that are started beforehand that are concluded. Wilson runs as a peace candidate in 1916 when he was. Actually, soon thereafter, angling to get the United States into the war.
Right.
So we deal with a lot of that. We deal with the fact that the United States was American bankers had loaned enormous amounts to the British and the French and very little to the other side. And so it was clear that the United States, if it was going to get involved in the war, was going to get involved on the side of the British and the French. We deal with that. We deal with a lot of the international tensions at the time between Wilson and Lenin, the different visions for the world that were emerging during that period. So there's a lot that we deal with in terms of the diplomacy of the war, as well as the way the war was fought. It was supposedly a war to make the world safe for democracy, but it was really much more of a war to divide up the old empires.
Yeah, yeah. And it certainly wasn't the war to end all wars, was it?
No, we know that.
Did you delve at all into, Wilson won re-election on the basis of the promise, you know, that he wouldn't get us into the war, which, of course, that's the opposite happened. And then later, of course, you got the same thing from FDR. His 1940 campaign was built around that theme. You know, I won't let your sons and daughters fight in any foreign wars. Did you see him as perhaps doing the same thing that Wilson was doing?
Yes, but we view World War I and World War II very differently.
Differently, yeah.
The World War I for us was a war that shouldn't have been fought, that the Americans knew that it shouldn't have been fought, and the United States should not have entered World War I. By the time the United States entered in 1917, the war had been going on for almost 3 years. We saw the horrors of trench warfare. We saw the futility. We knew that this was not a war based on principle on one side or the other. World War II is a very different kind of war because it was a war against fascism and Japanese militarism. So that was Roosevelt's heart was in the right place. The methods he used were very, very questionable because other presidents are going to later use those same deceptive methods for much more malign purposes.
Did you guys bring in the illegality factor of, the Cold War engagements that, you know, we never once, and to this day, into the war on terror, we've never had the constitutionally required congressional declaration of war for any of the military engagements we've been involved in since World War II. Do you guys, get into that at all?
Yes. We begin with Korea as the first time that we avoided doing that. And the United States has consistently presidents have not gone to Congress to get authorization for U.S. military involvement.
So that
concerns us quite a bit.
Yeah, that's a very big problem. Essentially, it turns the president basically into a dictator. If he can have power to deploy troops single-handedly, that's not how it was supposed to run.
Right, and we look at some of the powers that Obama has accrued, and certainly the powers that Bush had accrued before that, and we see that as an ominous trend. We're very critical of Bush for having conducted surveillance illegally without judicial review. And we're, of course, much more critical of Obama for targeting people and assassinating people without any judicial review.
Yeah, 9/11, of course, has been used as the excuse for a lot of things, and that's certainly one of them. I remember several congressmen, Ron Paul among them, made statements to the effect that 9/11 isn't the reason for laws like the Patriot Act. It's the excuse that they had laws like this on the drafting board for quite some time that they were trying to get passed through.
Oliver, did you?
No, I think you should go to the Pact of the New American Century.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, let's talk about that, sure.
Because that was formed in 1998, was it, Peter?
Well, they started actually formulating the programs even earlier.
Yeah, 97.
And we trace it back to the 1960s, really, when these people who would later become the neocons were beginning to organize. And many of them organized around Scoop Jackson in the Senate, Senator from Boeing, as he was called.
Sure.
And that's where you get Wolfowitz and Pearl and some of the others, really.
Even further, of course, Strauss and Trotsky, they were heavily influenced by their philosophy, but formally they were organized. I think it was 1997.
Yeah.
PNAC itself. But, of course, you know, probably the most draconian thing that came out of that was their 2000 report, Rebuilding America's Defenses. Did you guys address that?
Yes, of course, because they say there, in order to put through the kind of massive increase in defense spending and modernization that they want, said it will require a new Pearl Harbor. And then when we get our equivalent of a new Pearl Harbor on 9/11, they're ready to pounce. And they, as you suggest, do implement a lot of the policies that they foreshadowed in their earlier reports. And then one of the things they focused on extensively was Iraq. And these people had been, Wolfowitz had been talking about Iraq for decades. and some of the others were also fixated on Iraq. So they were ready to move on Iraq very, very quickly, as we show in great depth.
Well, my mind was blown to discover that 2 weeks prior to the outbreak of that war, in fact, it was March 5th of 2003, he was on Nightline with Ted Koppel. And he came right out and said, it's no secret. This is about oil. Anybody can go to our website, newamericancentury.org, and see that we had been talking about this back in September of 2000. He actually admitted that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there we were, under the pretext of WMDs. It's amazing.
And of course, Cheney was talking about the need for oil very, very openly, and the pipelines that they were interested in.
Yeah, Mr. Halliburton, yeah. And then, of course, they get the unbidded contracts. It's astonishing what the American public just lets slip by or just doesn't even seem to care. I don't know. There needs to be a grand awakening.
What happened during that time, as you recall, was that the American public was scared. It was terrified. And the Bush administration did everything it could to exploit that sense of fear.
The post-9/11
People are scared, they don't think rationally. And but they played on this sense of fear throughout the 20th century and now into the 21st century. Fear is a great motivator in a negative sense, and these administrations have learned how to do that.
Now, Mr. Stone, I know you got a lot of flack for your JFK film. Do you think that that's loosened up a little bit? Do you see people becoming more open-minded, you know, in Hollywood circles or in the country in general? Do you think people are being more open-minded, or are they still resistant to alternative thinking, you know, with the material they're presenting now? They're more open-minded?
Charles, I cannot answer that. I mean, I think that I don't know that most people think. I mean, I don't know that they're willing to. You've asked me a very tough question.
Have you been getting a lot of flack, like, within Hollywood circles, like I know you did with the JFK film?
No, I would just, you know, as a filmmaker, I would say that it was a divide in my life, and so far as after that, I was always categorized and marginalized to some degree as a politically motivated filmmaker only. And I think if you look at my body of my work, I've done a lot of other things too. So, although I do care about politics, and I've stated always my positions when asked, I haven't volunteered them. I just don't feel that a filmmaker has the right to say, you know, well, I don't, you know, my movies are just movies. I never said that. I've always said my movies are important to me, and I'm responsible for them, and I'm responsible for what I say. I do my research, and I believe in what I do. So, you know, I've run into that issue of being considered hard-headed and opinionated and so forth, and there are people, I suppose, who despised me from decades ago. So, you know, what do you do with your life? Do you live it the way you feel is right, or do you cotton to the critics?
The pressures,
Fold your weight, exactly. Fold your tent and get out of there.
So I don't imagine you've ever been invited to any CIA Christmas parties.
Not recently, no, but they used to like me when I did Platoon, and actually they very much like that. And a lot of military people have come up to me publicly. Just last week I was in Puerto Rico. Several military Americans came up to me and shook my hand. So, you know, it's not everyone in the military feels I served, and they respect that. I served in Vietnam.
Excellent. And I've got several students who are naval officers who talk very highly of Oliver's films. So this is certainly not universal.
Excellent. You had the privilege of working with Jim Garrison in his final years there. I guess he was pretty sick even when you were making JFK.
He was very sick, but he was an amazing figure, towering figure, 6'7". Still held his head. He held his head high. He went through hell, You know, the film was based on four different stories. Jim's story. I also bought another book by Jim Mars. I met with a lot of different witnesses.
Fletcher Prouty.
Fletcher Prouty.
Yeah.
Who was an astonishing figure who served in the Pentagon as lieutenant colonel. And so you knew a lot about the inside operations.
So you did deal with him directly? He was still around then?
Oh, Fletcher, yes, he was very influential. He, in fact, the Sutherland character, the Donald Sutherland character in the movie, is somewhat based on him, as well as another gentleman who had died. So, and the Oswald story, I got to know Marina. I knew. I mean, I was, you know, I've witnessed. Oh, wow. I probably interviewed more people at Dealey Plaza than probably any living person. I think, unless it's an FBI agent, but I'm not so sure that the FBI agent would reveal everything he knew.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That goes without saying. But, wow, very interesting. You've talked with some big, big names. Most of them, unfortunately, are no longer with us.
No.
But, I mean, he strikes me as a very decent. He must have been a very...
I'll tell you something about Jim Garrison. I mean, he was run down by the media. I mean, especially in New Orleans, but from all over the country. But when I walk through the streets of the old quarter with Jim, I cannot tell you how many people came up to him and shook his hand and knew him as an honest district attorney. And that was one thing that they really, you know, they kept insisting that he'd been bribery and all the usual Louisiana stories. But this guy, I don't ever believe took a bribe. I really think he held his head high and he walked the streets as Big Jim. People respected him.
Yeah,
it's amazing how the difference between what the people on the street do and what the editors and the higher ups think. It's amazing.
Sure. Yeah, he did strike me as that kind of person. I've seen some interviews with him. Of course, I read his book. He was just a straight shooter that didn't play games. He loved the truth. He wanted the truth out, and it cost him a great deal.
Oh yeah, he made mistakes. You know, he did have. He made mistakes, there's no question, and he writes about some of that in the book. But
yeah,
he tried. He was the only public prosecutor who could brought any kind of case at that time.
To this day,
and
that
is to be lauded. You know,
yeah.
Because nobody was doing anything. Everybody was covering up, including, you know, everybody was covering up.
And, of course,
it was too big a tortilla.
Yeah, he had some scary experiences. You know, he was visited by some high ups. They offered him a high position in the Supreme Court, and you know, he went through the whole gamut. Anyway, I wanted to ask you, Peter. Do you discuss a lot of these things, like PNAC, for example, with your students? Or?
PNAC, yes. Well, my students. I mean, it's interesting the way this Oliver's trajectory and my trajectory converged in this project. I mean, these are the themes that Oliver is developing in all of his feature films and documentaries that he's made over the years. These are also the themes that I've been teaching my students for over 20 years as well. And so our vision of U.S. history had converged to the point where we could lay out this idea of the history of the American Empire and the history of the national security state and show the corrosive effects of militarism on American life and the dangers of a society that's willing to sacrifice civil liberties for a phony sense of security. And so we're very concerned about the overall broad dynamics and trends that have been occurring, and that's what we reveal. We show the patterns. We show the patterns over a 100-year period. We show the patterns that lead to a Barack Obama, the tremendous constraints on Obama, the ways in which Obama has tried to resist some of these forces, but on the other hand has gone along with more than Oliver and I would like to see. But it's a pattern. He's not an enigma, and he's not an aberration. It's part of a long pattern, and that's what we're laying out here from the very beginning. How the United States gets involved in wars, why the United States supports certain interests, why the United States has such an enormous gap between rich and poor, why we're pursuing policies that Oliver and I see as very, very wrong-headed. And we're trying to get people to question, to think, and to understand that it didn't have to be this way, that we've come very close to having other kinds of outcomes that would have put the United States on a very different course, and that one Oliver and I think in some ways would have been a much more healthy one for the United States and the world.
Yeah, these policies have put not only our economy in jeopardy, but of course our very lives in jeopardy. They've made us hated in many parts of the world unnecessarily. I mean, we're in debt over our heads. People don't realize how much this has turned our economy inside out. It's benefited a few at the top, but everybody else, you know, has come out the loser in this game. And it's not stopping.
no, it's not stopping. Although I'm glad to see that Obama's putting up some resistance to the Republican right wing on the budget issues. That's a good sign. And he's been strengthened by the Occupy movement in the United States and by people who are out there protesting and making very clear the Occupy movement might not have succeeded as a movement, but it certainly succeeded in spreading a message that this gap between rich and poor in the United States is unconscionable and unendurable, that this has got to be changed. And that's resonated with much of the public, as we saw in the election, and it's resonated with Obama to some extent. So we see that as a very, very positive sign.
That we're just not going to...
Among the themes we stress is the danger of the nuclear arms race. We trace this back to its very, very beginning, even before, of course, the dropping of the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We talk about how the United States' monopoly on nuclear weapons influenced U.S. behavior throughout the early part of the Cold War, and how the United States has fomented this nuclear arms race and triggered it and spurred it at every point. And what a risk that is, what a threat that is to humanity even today. With you've got these countries, the United States and the Russians especially, but other countries also. India and Pakistan came very, very close to a nuclear war. And who knows how these things spread? They've both got allies.
Yeah.
We know the history of India and China. We know these are very dangerous situations that we think people have got to become aware of so that we can begin to make some changes.
I hear you. One final question. Either one of you can address this. Coming back to the PNAC thing, and particularly their Rebuilding America's Defenses that came out in September 2000. They made a statement in there. Well, there was actually quite a few jaw-dropping statements. The one about we need to transfer the use of chemical and biological weapons to a more politically useful tool that can target certain genotypes. They actually stated that in there. That's pretty shocking stuff. But even beyond that was the famous statement about the need to invade Iraq in the coming years to seize its oil reserves so the U.S. could remain the dominant force in the world, and the need for a, quote, new Pearl Harbor-type event to accomplish this, you know, to get the American public behind them. Did you guys address that at all?
Yes, we certainly addressed that. And the theme that we're developing in part is that there were two visions for the United States laid out in 1941 and 1942. It was Henry Luce from the Time Life Empire. In his vision, he said in an editorial that the 20th century must be the American century. But there was an alternative vision that was presented by Henry Wallace, who's a man who's been lost to history. Henry Wallace was Roosevelt's vice president from 41 to 45, and
sure,
Wallace was a visionary. And Wallace said the 20th century shouldn't be the American century. It's got to be the century of the common man. And he called for a worldwide people's revolution to end imperialism, colonialism, economic exploitation, monopolies, cartels. And he had an alternative vision. And what we're showing in part is that had Wallace become president in 45 instead of Truman, that the country could have gone on a very different course. And we show in a very dramatic way that Wallace came literally within, had Claude Pepper gotten 5 more feet to the microphone on July 20th, 1944, at the Democratic Convention, then Wallace would have been back on the ticket as vice president and become president in 1945 instead of Truman. So we're trying to show the history. We're showing that the sure, project for New American Century is rooted, really, in a certain vision of America that goes back to the 1940s and it goes back to the 1890s. But there are alternative visions, and that's what we're trying to emphasize, really.
And echoing that would be Hillary Clinton's statement recently that the 21st century would be the America's Pacific century.
Yeah, it's pretty sad. People think that imperialism ended, you know, when the British Empire crumbled, but no, it just, you know, its headquarters changed across the pond, as they say, under a different guise, but it's the same game.
And we have a lot about the British Empire and the fact that Roosevelt understood that this was a three-way competition that was going on. Roosevelt was very much opposed to the British and French and the other empires at that time. Truman didn't share that vision. which is another way in which, had Wallace become president instead of Truman, the colonialism could have ended much, much earlier, as it should have.
Right. Well, anyway, gentlemen, unfortunately we've run out of time. There's so much to talk about. I wish we had more time, but I appreciate you taking out time from your busy schedules to join us, especially you, Mr. Stone. I know you're busy. Yeah, I know you've been busy editing, and glad you could take the time to spend with us here. Keep up the good work. Looking forward to more films like this coming out and more books in the future.
Thank you, Charles.
Okay, take care.
Good luck to you, too. And
you, too.
Thanks for having us.
You bet.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, folks, join us next week. We're going to have Miko Peled, if I'm pronouncing that right. He's the author of The General's Son. So I'm going to be talking about his father's involvement in the Mossad. He's going to talk about some of the shenanigans of Israel over the years. He's himself an Israeli, so he's definitely qualified, his father having been a general in the Israeli army. You know, so he's talking firsthand experience. So you don't want to miss that. We'll see you next week. Have a good week, folks. Take care.
This land is your land. This land is
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made.